Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Americans are living longer. Life expectancy is up to 77 years for men and 80 for women, and more people are living well into their 80s, 90s, and beyond. But living longer doesn't necessarily translate into living healthy. How can we avoid a frail old age beset with illness and decline? That's the question America's alternative health guru, Dr. Andrew Weil, tries to answer in his book, Healthy Aging. He says the foundation to healthy aging rests on a good diet and exercise, as we may expect, but it also rests on acceptance and a celebration of the spiritual gifts of aging. Andrew Weil teaches about integrative medicine at the University of Arizona. He also heads the Foundation for Integrative Medicine in Tucson. He's the editor of the popular website, Ask Dr. Weil, and he's authored 8 books, including Spontaneous Healing and 8 Weeks to Optimum Health. I spoke to him last year about his latest book, Healthy Aging, A Lifelong Guide to Your Physical and Spiritual Well-Being. Dr. Andrew Weil, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
I absolutely loved your book.
Thanks.
I've been following your writings for a good 20 years. I don't know whether it's my age, because I'm in my late 50s, but I really found this one just absolutely terrific.
Great. Well, I really wrote it for everyone. You know, it's for people of all ages, including parents of young kids. And I try to refine and condense all of my lifestyle advice into it.
Yes, and in fact, I thought of getting it for my son, because it's very clear in your book, Healthy Aging, that you've got to start early.
The earlier in life that you begin to make better lifestyle choices, the greater the influence you have over the way that you'll age. So it's never too early, and conversely, it is never too late. I think at any age that you begin to improve diet or adopt better patterns of physical activity, you get benefit from that.
Well, let's start out. I'd like to kind of go back a bit, because I noticed that in the late 70s and early 80s, you were on the research staff of the Harvard Botanical Museum and conducted investigations of medicinal and psychoactive plants. So you really seem to straddle a divide between mainstream or allopathic medicine and holistic alternative medicine. You've been doing that for quite a long time.
Right, and that's what I call integrative medicine, and this is what I teach and practice, and I'm happy to say that more and more physicians are coming around to that point of view.
Tell us what integrative medicine is.
Well, the short answer is that it's the thoughtful combination of conventional and alternative medicine, but you know, a better answer is that this is a movement which is trying to restore the focus of medicine on health and healing, especially in the body's ability to repair itself, that looks at all aspects of lifestyle and looks at people as more than just physical bodies and emphasizes the practitioner-patient relationship. And as I said, this is a real momentum game that's happening here. This is the kind of medicine that people want. And I think it's also the kind of medicine that's going to make more and more financial sense as the healthcare system collapses, because it offers the promise of bringing lower cost treatments into the mainstream that produce outcomes that are as good, or I think in many cases better, than those of conventional medicine alone.
Lower cost treatments?
Yes. For example, you know, I teach simple breathing exercises, not only to reduce stress, but to lower blood pressure, to deal with heart arrhythmias, to improve digestive complaints. Breathing exercises are free, and they're a lot less costly than the pharmaceutical drugs that are used for many of these conditions.
Do you still feel, though, that there's an uphill battle for acceptance from the mainstream?
Certainly not from the public. You know, this is, as I said, the kind of medicine that people want. And I think increasing numbers of doctors are coming around to this point of view. I think there is still opposition from an older generation of physicians and from some people in the basic science areas who see this as being unscientific. I think the real practical obstacle is that insurance doesn't pay for these interventions. So, you know, an insurance company, payers will pay completely for doctors to prescribe drugs or do invasive procedures, but they don't pay for a doctor to sit down and counsel a patient about healthy eating. So that's what really has to change.
Well, you know, I can understand that. I've been, as a sideline to my regular work, I've been a massage therapist for 25 years. And, you know, it's always been clear to me that early intervention can prevent a lot more costly and invasive procedures later on.
Of course.
However, many people get massage also not necessarily because they need it for medical reasons or immediate medical reasons, but because it feels good. And so insurance companies have been very reluctant to pay for things like massage or acupuncture, which they think people are misusing.
Well, I think that the challenge is to present the insurance companies with data that really show that paying for these interventions saves everyone money in the long run. And I'm quite confident that we can do that, and I'm working on trying to organize some of those outcome studies.
Wonderful. Where could we expect to see them? Who are you working with?
Well, you know, I direct a program at the University of Arizona, the program in integrative medicine that's been in existence for 10 years, and there's a group in existence now called the Consortium of Academic Health Centers for Integrative Medicine. We have almost 30 member medical schools. So I think that, you know, a lot of these schools want to participate in this kind of outcomes research.
Another aspect before we leave this is allopathic medicine's focus on disease rather than health versus, I think, integrative medicine, which really does focus on health. Do you see that there are actual contradictions that are going to have to be resolved between integrative medicine and the dictates, for example, of the pharmaceutical industry?
I do. I mean, I think that standard medicine is going to become more and more focused on dealing with crises and very serious illness. But I think that integrative medicine is much better at prevention, at dealing with the mild and common conditions that are out there. Pharmaceutical drugs clearly have their place in treatment, but I think they're widely overused today. And in many cases, there are alternatives that are cheaper and safer and often more effective.
Can you give an example that you've seen, let's say, with a common...
Well, I mean, one of the commonest conditions that I see today is gastroesophageal reflux disease.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this didn't exist 30, 40 years ago. People just had heartburn. But now it's treated with very strong pharmaceutical drugs that were never intended to be used long-term. There are some very good strategies. One of them is a licorice extract called DGL. Which makes the lining of the stomach and esophagus more resistant to acid. And DGL is cheap, it's easily available, it's completely safe, and that's just one example.
Hmm. Now, in your new book, Healthy Aging, A Lifelong Guide to Your Physical and Spiritual Well-Being, you've turned to the subject of aging. A lot of folks may pick up that title thinking that your book is going to tell them how to extend their lifespan.
Well, they'll be very disappointed. You know, I think that we are bombarded in this culture at the moment with voices telling us that we should turn back the clock, we can stop the clock, we can grow younger. I have to tell you that all of that is impossible. I have reviewed all of the science in this area, and I would say that, you know, there's a theoretical possibility that at some point in the future we'll be able to manipulate genes that influence longevity, but we have no practical methods of doing that at the moment, and we're not likely to have them in the foreseeable future. And I think that all the talk about anti-aging really distracts us from what should be the important goal, and that's how to live long and stay healthy. So what we really want to focus on is reducing the risk and delaying the onset of age-related disease, the big diseases like cardiovascular disease, cancer, Alzheimer's disease.
Right. You distinguish between senescence and longevity. I wonder if you could explain that.
Well, the question is, are these age-related diseases synonymous with aging? Is it necessary to get sick as we get old? And I think the answer there is clearly no, that these are separable. So it's possible to live long and well and have a rapid drop-off at the end. There's a technical term for this. I didn't invent it. It's been in the medical literature, but I'm trying to popularize it. It's called compression of morbidity, where morbidity has the medical meaning of sickness. So the idea is to squeeze the time of disability and decline at the end of life into as short a period as possible.
So we're going to have to go, and we probably are going to go, at the end of our 3 score and 10 or whatever it is, but that we can do that, we can be more healthy and suffer less at the end. Is that right?
Yes. I used an example of my mother who died last year at age 93. I think she was a very good example of healthy aging and compression and morbidity. She didn't necessarily have the best genetics. Her mother had stomach cancer in her 70s. Her father had Alzheimer's in his 70s. She had 3 sisters with cancer. But she took very good care of herself. She ate very well. She used dietary supplements wisely. She was physically active all of her life. She was very curious and adventurous, loved to travel. I told a story that when she was 89, I told her I'd take her anywhere for her birthday, and she said she wanted to go to Antarctica, so I took her to Antarctica. She did very well up until a year before her death, and then she had a rapid decline, but she died at home. She didn't have to go to a hospital. She didn't have to go to an assisted living facility. She had all her wits about her, and even on her last day, she had very productive interactions with family and friends. So I think that's how we'd all like to do it, and I think that's possible. I think there are ways that we can influence how we age that increase our chance of experiencing that kind of long, healthy life and then a rapid drop-off.
Now, you mentioned supplements. I want to say, first of all, this is probably the most expensive book I've ever read because I went out and spent about $130 on supplements after reading it. But I think it's money well spent. But my mother now is 85 years old. She spends about $4,000 to $5,000 a year on supplements. She probably takes about 50 or more pills a day, all different kinds of supplements. And frankly, I wonder if that might be affecting her.
It might. When patients come into our clinic at the University of Arizona in integrative medicine, we usually ask them to bring in the supplements that they're taking. And some patients come in with 2 shopping bags full.
Mm-hmm.
And we dump them out and go through them. And we ask, why are you taking this? And the answer is, I my neighbor's taking it. Or why are you taking this? I heard it on the radio. Or why are you taking this? I don't know. Often we can eliminate half or more of those as either being unnecessary or duplicative. I am a great believer in dietary supplements, but I think you want to inform yourselves about which ones are important and which aren't. I think everyone should take a good multivitamin, multimineral supplement, and additional vitamin D. And then beyond that, there are some things that have specific uses, but you want to know why you're taking these things, what the evidence is for them.
Well, there's been a lot of controversy over the fact that so much of the supplement industry is not regulated the way the FDA is. So how do you thread your way through these things? How do you know you're taking the right stuff?
Well, it would be great if your doctor could be your guide in this area. But the problem is that our doctors are not trained in this in their medical education. So, that's what I and my colleagues in integrative medicine are working to change. We're trying to develop curriculum for medical schools and for physicians that would equip them to answer these kinds of questions. In the meantime, I think you have to seek out reliable sources of information and also information about manufacturers as to which ones are good and which aren't. I've long argued that the FDA should set up a whole new division of natural therapeutic agents to regulate herbs and vitamins and so forth, but that has to be done not from the point of view of trying to thwart consumer access to these products, but rather to make sure that we have access to better products, better safety and better efficacy.
Right, and it does seem so often it's about thwarting access.
Yep.
Now, you have a website, is that right?
DrWeil.com, DrWeil.com, and a great deal of questions are archived there. So generally, the questions that you have, you'll find answered there. And there's also a vitamin advisor function that's free that asks you a lot of questions and then gives you recommendations for supplements. And you can go out and buy whichever brands you choose.
Great. Now, you say that aging is caused by something called caramelization, which sounds delicious, actually.
caramelization is these are reactions between proteins and sugars. And actually, that happens when you make caramel candy, which is why it's called that. But these reactions are abnormal in the body, and they result in products that damage DNA and cell membranes and probably are involved in the changes of aging. One of the influences on this is the kinds of carbohydrate foods that we eat. Carbohydrates that digest quickly, and that's generally products made from flour and sugar, most of the processed and refined convenience foods that are out there. These raise blood sugar and accelerate this process of abnormal reactions between sugars and proteins, whereas slow-digesting carbohydrates don't do that, and that's beans and sweet potatoes and winter squashes and whole grains or cracked grains.
And don't they have some implications also for weight gain?
Absolutely. That these quick-digesting carbohydrates also seem to be very involved in weight gain in many people, and I think that that's one of the great changes that's happened in the American diet in the past 50 years, that more and more of these refined and processed foods that raise blood sugar have displaced other kinds of foods from our diets. I think that's a major factor in childhood obesity.
Yeah. Now, this is also involved with antioxidants, and we know that antioxidants are good for us, and we know that dark chocolate is among these. I was absolutely thrilled when I found that.
Actually, dark chocolate turns out to have greater antioxidant activity than green tea or red wine. It's got to be good quality chocolate with at least 70% cocoa, and you don't want to eat it immoderately, you know, maybe an ounce or two a day. But I think this can be a very healthy addition to the diet, and also, you know, probably better than most of the desserts that people are eating.
Right. But I was really surprised to see that the list included opium and marijuana.
There's actually a body of research showing that the more different kinds of plants we include in our diet, the greater protection that we have from cancer and other kinds of chronic diseases. And that even includes the plant intoxicants that have been used in all cultures for millennia. So it's things like cot and opium and marijuana and betel and kava and, you know, the coca. And there's so many things that people around the world have used that in moderation, these plants, even though in large quantities they appear toxic, in small quantities seem to give us elements that the body can really use to increase its defensiveness.
So the counterculture was onto something.
It looks like.
Now, what about the role of environmental toxins in chronic disease? And you note that asthma is increasing, but also in areas with clean air, as in high smog areas.
Exactly.
So I'm wondering, you know, there's an awful lot of talk about other kinds of toxins that are really ubiquitous, the dioxins, the endocrine disruptors and things of that kind.
Well, I would say the bottom line is these things can't be good for us. So the only question is how bad they are. And I think in some instances the answer is pretty bad. I'd say where we're closest to proving a link with disease is with Parkinson's disease. And there has been, just in the past couple of weeks, some interesting papers coming out making that link look even tighter. And I would add to that also ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, you know, maybe Alzheimer's disease has a connection here as well. So this big group of neurodegenerative diseases look as if they result from toxic injury to the brain. Agricultural chemicals are very suspect as having this kind of effect, but it may be that there are many things in the environment that do. And you mentioned the endocrine disruptors. These are many products that are pollutants in the environment that act like estrogens especially and may raise risks of breast cancer in women, and similar chemicals may raise risk of prostate cancer in men.
Right, and it's a real conundrum with fish, because fish is on the one hand so healthy for us and on the other hand is so polluted. What do you do?
There was just a study that came out that said that much farmed salmon, especially from Norway, had so many toxins in it that its cancer-causing potential overrode the other health benefits. Now, here's a tip I would give your listeners. Sockeye salmon, or red salmon, is all wild. They haven't figured out how to farm that. And it sockeye salmon also is less carnivorous. It eats more insects and algae, so it's less likely to have environmental toxins in it. And you can get canned red salmon in any grocery store. So that's a perfectly good omega-3 source. Otherwise, if you're worried about fish, it may be easier for many people to take a fish oil supplement. You know, I recommend a gram a day, and the good brands are distilled, so they're free of contaminants, and there are even pleasant-tasting forms out there.
Hmm. Well, finally, you write about the denial of aging. And, you know, we have a pretty unrelenting youth culture. And you say
I think that's about to change. And this is why I felt it would be a good idea to get this book out there at this time. The baby boomers are going to start turning 60 next year. They are a very large and influential segment of the population. I don't think they're going to put up with the models of aging that have been held out the previous generations. I think they may be in a position to change some of our youth obsession in this culture.
Right, we're good for something.
Yeah.
But you say, though, you have a spiritual message, too, and you say that aging reminds us of our mortality, but that it can be a primary stimulus to spiritual awakening and growth. And I think this was some of the part of the book, I mean, aside from all the scientific information, which was really fascinating, this was some of the most meaningful part to me because, yeah, baby boomers, you know, we're not going to age the way our elders did. But on the other hand, we're still into denying the healthy role of aging.
Good. I'm glad that spoke to you. I do think that paying attention to, being aware of how the body changes, the fact that we're moving toward death, that this can be a major stimulus to spiritual awakening and motivation to attend to spiritual matters. Carl Jung said that he thought that this should be a major focus of the second half of life, and that anything that took away from it, he thought was mentally unhealthy. So I do really believe that, and that's why I worry about the extent to which we deny aging. We tell each other, you're looking younger, why so many people try to mask the outward signs of aging.
Today, listening on the radio up to here, there was talk about, you know, the Botox, all the ways that people, in fact, feel that they have to look younger if they're
right.
Going to even be socially acceptable.
I think this is a peculiar distortion in our culture. I wrote about other cultures where there are very different attitudes toward aging, where the old are honored and valued, and there's no interest in them in trying to conceal their age. So I think we could change things here, and I think this is the time to try to begin to do that.
Well, the book is Healthy Aging, A Lifelong Guide to Your Physical and Spiritual Well-Being. And thank you, Andrew Weil, for
pleasure to talk to you.
Writing this book and speaking with us.
Okay.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Dr. Andrew Weil. That's it this week for Writer's Voice, airing on this station and podcasting on the web at writersvoice.net. Please join us next week for a Thanksgiving Day special about, what else? Food. We talk with Nina Plank about her book, Real Food, What to Eat and Why. She says traditional foods like butter, whole milk, and grass-fed beef are good for you, and so-called industrial foods aren't. And we also talk about how to avoid overeating with food psychologist Brian Wansink. He talks about his new book, Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. To learn more about Writer's Voice, visit our website at writersvoice.net. And again, please send your thoughts, comments, and questions to write@writersvoice.net. You can also post directly to our blog at writersvoice.net. Until next week, I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Stay tuned for Fallen Through the Cracks with Corey Sharon.